Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. Today is Monday, December 3rd. I am Chirag Mahajan. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver and provincial news from British Columbia. Also on our show today is a repeat of a special report prepared by News 101 correspondent D.P. Lail on the TransLink BC's Handy Dart door-to-door transportation service that uses specially equipped vehicles for passengers with physical and cognitive disabilities. Also on today's show, we will be bringing you our weekly science segment, Simply Science with Sarah Chow. All this plus your weekday weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada. Our local weatherman, Phil, is out for a bit, but we will be giving you the best of the weather. It looks rainy so far. All right, and now for your campus and local headlines. Very dangerous avalanche conditions in the Sea to Sky region prompted the Canadian Avalanche Center to issue a high danger rating in the area for the first time this winter. According to the bulletin issued last week, travel in the Alpine region is not recommended with a major snow dump expected over the next few days. The bulletin says human-triggered avalanches are, quote-unquote, very likely during a high danger rating. The avalanche risk goes down to considerable at the tree line and to moderate below the tree line. This is, of course, the Sea to Sky region going up to Whistler and beyond. Every year, avalanches claim an average of 14 lives in Canada. The first reported fatality occurred earlier than usual this year when a surveyor lost his life to a slide in northwestern BC in October. In local news, the proposed 2013 city budget of Vancouver will raise property taxes 2% to provide a whole lot of new services for Vancouverites if City Council approves it next week. While Vancouver has the third lowest tax rate for homeowners of all municipalities in Metro Vancouver, the average homeowner still pays more than the Metro average. Police Department could get $2 million for a community safety program that will put 40 unarmed officers on the ground. The program hopes to speed response times and improve community safety by having these officers respond to property crime, parking complaints, and quality of life issues. Also, if passed, millions of dollars will be dedicated to a variety of community services, according to this budget. $9.6 million to affordable housing, $14.4 million to parks, and $11.8 million to bike and pedestrian route safety improvements. The budget also states that fire and rescue services could also get an extra $700,000. Arts, cultural, and social grants will receive an extra $300,000. And for $1 million, downtown could get high-tech solar-powered dumpsters that compact trash to hold more than twice as much waste and notify garbage collectors when they're full. More info on the proposed 2013 city budget can be found online at vancouver.ca. Community gardens might root a little deeper as City Council voted to study how to increase their long-term security. As it stands, the city leases land to community gardens for years at a time, but can evict the gardeners with 30 days' notice if it needs the space for something else. Developers can get tax write-offs if they allow temporary gardens to be built on land awaiting development. The garden security motion passed last Wednesday during City Council after hours of heartfelt public testimony that expressed the importance of community gardens and addressed fears that potential viaduct removal could harm sections of two of Vancouver's oldest gardens, the Cottonwood and Strathcona Gardens in the east side. While the city has spent $468,000 on a concept plan that recommends removing the viaducts, it has yet to be approved by council. Even if the viaducts are removed, a new connection along Malkin Avenue is just one option. The city will hold consultations on what viaduct alternatives could look like early next year. A local outdoor clothing manufacturer is teaming up with Vancouver Police to help ease the winter burdens of the city's homeless, one cape at a time. North Vancouver's Arctrix will be partnering with the VPD's Homeless Outreach Program to hand out hundreds of waterproof and insulated capes to the city's most vulnerable. In the past, Arctrix has distributed the capes made from leftover fabrics and sewn by volunteer employees at the company's Burnaby factory. Through the Harvest Project in North Vancouver and the Harbor Lights and First United Church in Vancouver. Joanne Mays, Corporate Social Responsibility Manager at Arctrix, said that the cape idea was a good way to reduce the company's carbon footprint as well as an opportunity to give back to the community. In the last 3 years, she added, the company has given out more than 1,000 capes this year, and this year they will be giving out 300 capes to the VPD to widen their distribution. In provincial news, the BC government and its Ministry of Health Services says it's committing $19.9 million in new annual funding to expand a program aimed at ending HIV transmission altogether. The Stop HIV/AIDS program has dramatically slashed HIV infection rates in the province since starting up in 2009, with $48 million for a four-year pilot. Health Minister Margaret McDermott said on last Friday that the Stop HIV/AIDS pilot, which initially targeted Vancouver and Prince George, is being rolled out throughout the province starting April 1st next year. Margaret McDermott said the funding will go towards new outreach programs, new HIV testing methods, more frontline staff, and will cover other prevention and treatment programs. Dr. Julio Montaner, who leads the BC Centre for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, said the program is working towards eliminating the disease altogether in the province, which is the only place in Canada showing a consistent decline in new HIV diagnoses. New HIV infections have decreased from about 900 new cases each year in the mid-1990s to 289 new cases in 2011. It's estimated 13,000 British Columbians have HIV/AIDS, while another 3,500 are likely unaware they are living with HIV. The province offers free medication to infected residents, which a study shows has played a major role in the decline. In more budget news, British Columbia's projected deficit for the 2012-2013 fiscal year has grown by $328 million since September and $500 million since last February's budget. Finance Minister Mike Dijon said he is confident, however, that in February the government will be able to present a balanced budget for next fiscal year, a commitment Premier Christy Clark reaffirmed yesterday. But unlike Clark, Dijon didn't rule out raising taxes to do it. A new deficit figure halfway through the year, through the budget year, is $1.469 billion. The larger deficit comes despite collecting $308 million extra dollars in personal and corporate income taxes. Those gains were more than offset by declines that included a delay in the sale of the Little Mountain property in Vancouver, lower than expected property transfer tax revenue, and lower natural resources revenue. In the current year, along with the growing deficit, the government continues to seek $65 million in cuts to make up from ministries to make up for a decline in natural gas revenues that Dijon announced in December. And those were your local and provincial headlines. We are going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for our special report by our news correspondent, DP Lail. This is on the Transnet BC's Handy Dart door-to-door service. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca. Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live on the FM dial and online at citr.ca. It is now time for a repeat of our special report prepared by News 101 correspondent DB Lail and produced by Claire Eagle on the TransLink BC's Handy Dart door-to-door transportation service that uses specially equipped vehicles for passengers with physical and cognitive disabilities.
I'm DP Lail reporting for News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Today, I will be bringing you a story about the Handy Dart transportation service. Handy Dart is a transportation bus that is owned by TransLink, so that disabled persons and seniors can travel on their own whenever they would like. However, in the last 4 years, Handy Dart standards have slipped and the current level of service is inadequate. There are fewer buses on the road to serve the people's needs, and as the population ages, this is only going to get worse. The Handy Dart service is extremely important for maintaining users' physical and mental well-being because they often cannot use other types of transportation. Without Handy Dart, they lose their independence and freedom. I had the pleasure to speak to three individuals who have some knowledge about Handy Dart transportation. First, I had a chance to speak with Linda McGowan, who is the Consumer Advocacy Manager for MVT Canadian Bus. Here, Ms. McGowan gives us background information on what she does and what Handy Dart is. Hello, Ms. McGowan. Thank you for meeting with me today. Is MVT a part of TransLink, or is it a different division?
MVT Canadian Bus Incorporated is a private Canadian company that has been contracted by TransLink to provide Handy Dart services. TransLink owns Handy Dart.
What does MVT stand for?
It's called Medical Van Transportation.
How long have you been with MVT Canadian Bus Corporation?
I became an employee in November 2008.
So 4 years. Can you tell us a bit about your role with MVT Canadian Bus Corporation?
My role is I'm the consumer advocate. The Vancouver system is very large. And what I do is I work with individuals and families anywhere where there's people with disabilities needing Handy Dart transportation. I'm available 7 days a week, 7 evenings a week when I'm in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. The only exception is that when the Stanley Cup playoffs are on, you have to phone between periods.
What changes has the company made on its operations and services recently?
One of the main things is prior to that time, there were 8 different providers who did things 8 different ways. Mm-hmm. Now, they tried to make the system consistent between all municipalities. Mm-hmm. And prior to MVT coming to Vancouver, many of the municipalities did not provide service outside their own municipality. For anything other than a direct medical appointment, the service stopped at Boundary Road.
Can you tell us about the changes that have occurred from changing from a non-profit to a for-profit organization?
Unfortunately, Vancouver is growing. There are more people requesting Handy Dart type service, and there's less service available. We currently have 50 fewer buses than we had 3.5 years ago. The service hours that were provided last year have not increased for this year. So Handy Dart provides somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 trips every day. It's a first-come, first-served basis. And when the buses are fully scheduled, they're fully scheduled.
Why are there less buses on the road than compared to a couple of years ago?
I think it's the cost thing, is that as the buses retire, they bought new buses, but the new buses cost more, and they don't buy as many as they take off the road.
How do you think these changes have impacted Handy Dart users?
The changes related to the growth is that there is less service hours available, and people are getting denied more often. At the beginning, when MVT came, you could call 1 to 7 days in advance, and you can still do that. But if you wait to call 2 days in advance, your chances of getting what you want are getting pretty slim.
Do you think Handy Dart users have suffered because of these changes?
Well, they've certainly had improvement. The fact that Handy Dart will go cross-boundary is an improvement. The reminder phone calls are an improvement. What's difficult is the reduction in hours and reduction in service hours and the reduction in buses and the increase in population. You combine all of those, I think it puts more pressure on people with disabilities getting the kind of transportation they want and need.
Why have there been cutbacks in buses?
I think it's a financial thing. Yeah. Buses cost a lot of money. There's pressure in the community to use the money and spread it around everywhere.
What kinds of complaints are you getting from your customers regarding Handy Dart service?
I get that Handy Dart is late, that it took me a long time to get where I'm going. We get some complaints about staffing. Generally, our drivers are worth the weight in gold, but I always say there's one bad apple in every barrel. And we get complaints that I need this trip, and they can't do it for me.
Are your revenues based on fixed grants, or is it made through a fee per rider?
MVT is provided a certain number of money every year, and they must provide a certain number of service hours within that budget.
Okay.
So if the buses need more maintenance or too many people are sick, that all comes out of, the MBT has to accommodate that within the budget.
So for someone who's paying for a ticket or a bus pass, where does that money go?
That money goes to TransLink.
Okay. Where do you see the Handy Dart system 10 years from now?
I think if it's very busy now, it's going to be much busier in 10 years from now. I think in that time it will have to expand. I think that the eligibility to use Handy Dart may tighten up. I think you may be looking at smaller buses.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Linda, for meeting with me and allowing me to interview you.
Thank you.
The second individual I spoke to is Jody, a Handy Dart client that has had long-term experiences with the system and has seen many changes throughout the years. Hi, Jody. Thank you for meeting with us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Okay, my first question is, how long have you been taking the Handy Dart buses?
Quite a while. A long, long time.
Can you tell me about your experiences with Handy Dart?
I've had so many issues, like going to Vancouver and getting around in Richmond. And I've also called Handy Darts and booking and arranging Handy Darts and stuff and changing the time.
Are you happy with the service, and why and why not?
I'm not happy because sometimes it's tough for me. I have to wait for an hour and a half for my rides.
Are you able to get to all the places that you want to go? For example, in Vancouver or in Burnaby?
No, I don't, because that's the part I'm having difficulty with. With Burnaby, I have to be transferred and I can't travel by myself. I have to have someone with me.
Can you tell me more about your recent experiences with the Handy Dart and how the service has changed throughout the years?
Well, before it was so easy because I could get Handy Dart everywhere, but now that they changed the service, I think it's more difficulty. It's hard for me to press one like other numbers, and I think it should be, instead of saying press one, just say the number one.
So better access with the phone. And
yeah.
Okay. Has the service affected your ability to get around?
Yes, it has.
Can you give me an example of how it has affected you to get around, what stuff you need to do?
Well, I have to call 7 days in advance and have to call ahead to book wherever I want to go. And it's kind of tough. One time I took Maple Ridge and I had to be transferred 3 Handy Darts. That took me a while and I had to be there by 1. For return, I had to take 2 Handy Darts. So it's a long day for me. So I think they should have like a better service and more access.
Thank you very much, Jody, for allowing me to talk to you.
No problem.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
The last person I spoke to is Beth, a support worker who has had a lot of experience working with clients that use the Handy Dart system. She also has a family member who takes this transportation service. Here she is giving her perspective on the system. Hi, Beth. Thank you for meeting with me today. My first question is, what are your thoughts on the current level of service at Handy Dart?
The drivers are great people, and they're trying to do a really tough job. It's the company that's not supportive of the client's needs. They do not put sufficient drivers on to handle the volume of the clients or the distance involved in the request by the clients. The drivers are often frustrated, and they have to backtrack a lot in order to give the service that the client is asking for.
Have you seen a lot of changes in the level of service in the last few years with the HandyTar?
Several changes. It used to run a lot smoother. The booking system is not set up for convenience to the client anymore. The need to call in a week in advance is difficult on a lot of occasions. And if you need a ride to a medical appointment and you cannot get short notice bookings made, it's becoming more frustrating for the clients to try and book rides.
Mm-hmm. How do you think HandyTar or the service itself can improve?
They need to improve on the evening services that they provide. There's many wheelchairs and people with walking disabilities that don't have any way to attend social functions, late jobs, schooling. For instance, when co-workers want to go to a Christmas party, people can get there, but there's no way home. There's no buses close to their place. There's no other way for people to get back, so they cannot attend functions like other adults, and they cannot socialize with their peers. That is a service that really needs to be looked at, because these are adults that need to be respected as adults. Just because you have a need doesn't mean that you should be treated so much differently in our society.
And you said there's no other buses. Are you saying TransLink buses and SkyTrains? Can anybody use those?
They can use them, but I don't know of a lot of people that have a bus stop directly in front of their home. Most people with disabilities do not have that privilege, and so to be able to access the SkyTrain and board a bus and then get off of the bus nearest to their home, it's an issue. And if it's an evening, especially a winter evening where it's probably rainy, the roads are shiny, cars don't even slow down for bicycles, never mind somebody with a slower mobility issue. So I think if the people running HandyTar actually had to walk with somebody late night, I think they would find out that the cold rain after a Christmas party isn't where they want to be either.
How do you think the level of service has affected the people that you work with?
When it runs according to their objective, it's a major influence on maintaining someone's independence. With such poor management that's been happening lately, it's very frustrating. And the priorizing that HandyTar is doing, it just leaves people in the lurch. The clients are not able to attend their group or the program activities. They're experiencing a lot of independence issues, because when they cannot get a ride to or from, then quite often they just have to cancel and not participate with groups or with jobs. Because of the poor management of HandyTar, people are losing their independence. And in this society, in this day and age, that is really disgraceful.
From your personal standpoint, how do you think the services have affected your mother and her mobility?
Initially, she's really thrilled that she's able to have a HandyTar service and be able to get to and from the programs that she wants to do in the daytime. However, dementia is an issue, and there's no way for a checkpoint system for regular riders. And when dementia is an issue, there again, this system is failing them, because there is no way for them to get a ride. And if most of the seniors cannot afford the taxis, a lot of seniors cannot just ride the bus. If they could, they wouldn't be using the HandyTar. And so there again, HandyTar really needs to look at this booking system that they have and the way that they need to be able to book in a shorter period of time and have a better scheduling process, so that when people do have a short notice request, even if it is fitting in a doctor's appointment suddenly because they've come down with the flu, They need to be able to get handy dart. They need to be able to get a ride. They need to be able to maintain a sense of independence just for their own personal well-being and state of mind.
For the place that she needs to be, mm-hmm. sometimes she forgets to call and book an appointment. Mm-hmm. How does she get there then? Does she go at all?
On a good day, when her dementia is not affecting her and where she's able to think things through, she can actually board a bus and get off at the right stop. Other days, she is so frustrated that she just retracts and stays in the house because she's so confused and upset.
Thank you very much, Beth, for taking the time to chatting with me.
You are welcome. This was a pleasure to be part of. Thank you.
Thank you.
As you heard from Linda, Jody, and Beth, although there are some parts of the Handy Dart service that do work well, overall, current operations are decreasing, and this is hurting passengers' well-being. If this service doesn't improve, people with disabilities will continue to see a decrease in their ability to travel, and this will affect their freedom and independence, holding them back from doing what matters in life. These activities are not only recreational, but they are also vital for individuals' mental and physical health. Families and caregivers will also be affected because they will be held back when an individual with disability is unable to travel. So I ask you, CITR listeners, do you think this is right? If not, please let Handy Dart know your concerns by calling Handy Dart at 604-575-6600, extension 5. Everyone can make a difference, and your voice counts. For News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, I'm DP Lale.
And thank you very much to DP Lil for that production. You can, of course, listen to that entire thing once again on our website, citr.ca/news. We are going to take a quick break here on CITR 101.9 FM. This is News 101. Stay tuned. We will be back with our weekday weather forecast and our science segment for the week.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM and online at citr.ca. Once again, you can listen to that segment by DP Lale on our website, citr.ca/news. It is now time for your weekday weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada. Tonight, we have periods of rain, about 15 to 25 millimeters, winds becoming east 30 kilometers per hour early this evening, except for southeast where they are up to 70, gusting to 90 kilometers an hour over southwestern sections before morning. There is currently a wind warning in effect, so please stay tuned for that over other radio stations as well. On Tuesday, rain ends in the morning with a mix of sun and cloud with 40% chance of showers. Wind heading east at 30 kilometers an hour, where except southeast, where the wind warning stays in effect, up to 90 kilometers an hour. Wind becomes light in the morning, but then becoming southwest 30 kilometers an hour late in the afternoon. Temperatures high of 10 degrees Celsius. Wednesday, we have a cloudy sky with 60% chance of showers and a high of 7 and a low of 6 degrees Celsius. Thursday is also rain, with a low of plus 5 and a high of 8 degrees. Friday is also rain, with a low of 6 and a high of 8. So that is your weekday weather forecast here on News 101. Also keep in mind, a wind warning is currently in effect for the Lower Mainland. So look for more information, please go to Environment Canada at weatheroffice.gc.ca. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for our weekly science segment. This is Simply Science by Sarah Chow.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. Being diagnosed with cancer is pretty damn scary. Questions pop up in your head. What do you do? How long do I live? How do I cope? And what is the cure? And the cure is something. Salvatore Iaconese, a professor in digital design at the Sampia University of Rome, is taking into his own hands. He created an open source cure. What does that mean? Well, Salvatore Iaconese was diagnosed with glioblastoma, a type of brain cancer, and he's looking for a cure, but not just any old cure. A cure for both his mind, body, and soul. And because he wanted a more complete approach to his cure, he wanted to have personal access to his medical records and share them with various types of doctors. But these records were inaccessible, so he made them accessible by cracking his own files and then transforming them into a format everyone could understand and stuck them on his website, La Cura, for everyone to see. He even has a brain scan of his tumor on his site. And this is what he calls open source cure. And here's why he decided to take this approach.
For medicine, sometimes you are just a fitting part of an equation, okay? You have a disease because you have some symptoms, and there's a diagnosis, and then there's a therapy, okay? You are an equation. But that's not all there is to it, obviously. So I decided to change this situation. What I did is to start from information. Everything starts at you, human being, disappearing and becoming a patient. And the data which is associated to your body, to the human being, is expressed in very peculiar languages, which are not languages for human beings, are languages for doctors. So what I did is to start from there. I took my clinical records and I transformed them into a very personal version of open data. I put them on the web, and I created a thing which I called Open Source Cure.
And since September of this year, there have been 35 videos and 600 poems written about him. 15,000 testimonials others have shared about their fight with cancer. 60 doctors have contacted him about advice. And these are not just any old doctors. These are real professionals. There has been 5,000 strategies to cure his cancer, and 200 people have helped him figure out which is legit. Cure. His own strategy to save his life. And since then, he's decided on an open source cure strategy.
As of now, through all this help, I have formed my strategy. And my strategy to confront with cancer is a very peculiar strategy because it's way beyond what classical medicine does. It's a strategy that goes all around the world and across thousands of years of cultures, because it's a strategy which unites harmoniously surgery, oncology, homeopathy, Chinese medicine, Hebraic esotericism, and a radical change in lifestyle and diet.
And he thinks this is the best way to go about getting a cure.
No one commiserates me. It's fantastic. It's the perfect situation to get healed. No one is sad and everyone does something. And most important of all, everyone involved is really feeling part of a human society.
For more information about his journey to battle cancer, you can check out artisopensource.net/cure. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
Thank you, Sarah Chow, for bringing us that Simply Science segment. You can, of course, listen to it once again on our website, citr.ca/news. You are listening to News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international headlines.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I am Chirag Mahajan, your sole host for today's show. It is now time for our international headlines, and for that we go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Citing security concerns, the United Nations is pulling all non-essential staff out of Syria today and putting those who remain on standby. Russian President Vladimir Putin was in Istanbul today, where he met with Turkey's president, who called on Russia to stop supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia says it's not supporting Assad, it just doesn't want to see the past repeated. Putin also opposes NATO deploying Patriot missiles to the Turkey-Syria border, where Syrian airstrikes over the weekend targeting rebel outposts strayed into Turkey. Most civilian flights in and out of Damascus remain canceled today, after fighting over the weekend for control of the airport. Internet and phone communications are still working today. They were restored Saturday after a 48-hour shutdown. Congolese troops re-entered Goma today, but M23 rebels remain poised on the outskirts of town. The M23 occupied the provincial capital almost 2 weeks ago, but agreed to retreat ahead of a negotiation deadline today. The move followed UN-imposed sanctions. International pressure was also brought to bear by the UK, which again halted aid to Rwanda because of concerns about its role in the DR Congo conflict. Gloria Kamkar reports.
UK International Development Secretary Justin Greening said that $34 million in aid would not be released after credible and compelling reports reveal that Rwanda's President Paul Kagame's government is providing weapons to the M23 rebels. The money was due to be paid this month. The conflict has led to the displacement of almost 500,000 people in eastern Congo, raising fears of a humanitarian crisis. The UK withheld $26 million in aid in July after an interim report by a UN panel of experts suspected Rwanda's support in the conflict, but the money was restored in September. Rwanda's Foreign Minister Louise Mushikiwabo has expressed disappointment at the UK government's decision. Gloria Kamkar, FSR in Southampton, United Kingdom.
The US has officially expressed deep concern about the situation in DR Congo and blocked $200,000 earmarked for a Rwandan military academy. But the administration has not implemented the Democratic Republic of the Congo Relief Security and Democracy Promotion Act. The law calls for non-humanitarian aid to be halted for any country that acts to destabilize the DRC. The 2006 measure was sponsored by then-Senator Barack Obama. The U.S. sends Rwanda $200 million each year. Egypt's Supreme Judicial Council announced today that it will monitor the polling for the country's proposed new constitution. Judges and attorneys will be assigned and mandated to serve. The referendum is scheduled for December 15th on the draft that's backed by the Muslim Brotherhood and President Mohamed Morsi. The constitution was quickly crafted after Morsi decreed himself beyond judicial reach and was written without input from minority groups or women. The Egyptian Judges Union remains on strike, and many local media outlets say they won't publish tomorrow in protest. Cargo ships are anchored off the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, California today as clerical workers continue their strike to prevent job outsourcing. Chris Bennett reports from L.A.
The 800-member office clerical unit of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union has worked without a contract for 2 years and seeks a pay increase of 2.5%. Union Communications Director Craig Merrilee says the strike is not simply about the money. The workers are trying to save their solidly middle-class jobs by preventing company managers from shifting the jobs to lower-wage areas such as Taiwan, Texas, and North Carolina. Merrilee says the strike is about the future of good jobs in the U.S. versus management turning those positions into low-wage junk jobs in other areas. Management negotiators contend that any new contract abolish the practice of feather-bedding or hiring workers during times when there's little work to do. Roughly 40% of all goods imported into the U.S. come through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa urged both sides to continue negotiations to prevent ripple effects throughout the Southern California and national economies. Chris Bennett, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Saturday was World AIDS Day, and across Canada this week, Indigenous communities are marking Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more.
Native communities in Canada have higher HIV/AIDS infection rates than those in non-Native populations. Events this week in Aboriginal communities are focused on a campaign of getting to zero, with the goal of avoiding all new infections, as well as raising awareness about discrimination and marginalization of AIDS patients. According to a 2011 public health report, Aboriginals accounted for 12% of all new AIDS infections that year, but they only make up around 4% of Canada's overall population. The report also found that Aboriginal people have the highest proportion of HIV infections attributed to injection drug use at 60%. One challenge is improving Aboriginal access to health care, as many remote reservations lack adequate services and often have to fly in doctors from other communities. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abraham.
A growing number of countries and world leaders are condemning Israel's announcement that it will build 3,000 new homes in a West Bank settlement expansion. This follows last week's vote at the United Nations General Assembly that gave Palestine non-member status. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called Israel's move an almost fatal blow to the chances of a two-state solution. Israel also announced it will withhold $100 million in taxes collected for the Palestinian Authority and apply it to debt owed for electricity. For more, we're joined by Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the US Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks so much for having me.
The British, French, Spanish and Swedish governments have summoned the Israeli ambassadors in their countries in protest at Israel's decision to approve the new settlement. Germany and Russia have urged Israel not to move forward with building settlements on Palestinian land. How significant is this European reaction, do you think?
I think it's very significant, but more significant is actually the fact of what Israel has done as a response to Palestine getting upgraded membership in the UN by moving forward with plans to build a new settlement in the area known as E1. Basically, what Israel is doing is cutting off Palestinian East Jerusalem from the remainder of the West Bank and also bisecting the West Bank into two, which will basically put the final nail in the coffin of any kind of attempt to establish a contiguous and viable Palestinian state in the future. So it's very significant. And the fact that you're seeing these recallings of ambassadors, I think, shows how displeased Europe is at Israel right now, as was evidenced by the vote on upgrading Palestine status at the UN last week, where you only had one EU country, the Czech Republic, vote against the initiative.
You've mentioned it there a little bit, but can you tell us a little bit more about this area that Israel is attempting to build on?
Right. Basically, what it will do is it will create a contiguous settlement belt between one of Israel's largest settlement blocks in the West Bank, which is called Maale Adumim, and connect that to Israel's illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. So Palestinians living in East Jerusalem will be completely surrounded by Israeli settlements. There'll be no connectivity between East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank, which is, of course, the hoped-for capital of a future Palestinian state. And it'll also make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, for Palestinians to move between the northern part of the West Bank and the southern part of the West Bank.
After meeting with the Israeli ambassador to the UK, the Minister for the Middle East, Alistair Burt, said he called on the Israeli government to reverse their decision. Apart from diplomatic pressure and strong statements like this, what options do world leaders really have to stem this settlement building?
Well, I think sanctions are really the only thing that Israel will listen to at this point to stop its illegal behavior. Clearly, the United States exercises a position in the United Nations where it's able to prevent the international community from imposing the types of arms embargoes and comprehensive sanctions that were placed on the apartheid regime in South Africa. But instead of having to go through the UN, global civil society is responding to a Palestinian civil society call for campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. For example, we were part of an initiative last week that called on Stevie Wonder to cancel a benefit concert for the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. And in light of the fact that he was such a staunch opponent of apartheid in South Africa, he responded to those calls from civil society and dropped his performance from this concert.
Just looking a little more at the U.S. reaction, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called the settlements a setback for peace when speaking at an event on Friday night in Washington. That event was attended by Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman and Defense Minister Ehud Barak. But the U.S. also stood by Israel in opposing that U.N. vote for non-member status at the United Nations. What would you like to see the U.S. say and do in response now?
The fact is that this illegal settlement building goes way beyond a setback or an obstacle to peace. And if the United States were serious about putting an end to Israel's illegal settlement construction, then it would halt military aid. It would halt its diplomatic support at the UN like it did last week when it voted against Palestine's upgraded status to really send a signal to Israel that there are consequences for its actions and consequences for Israel defying even the will of the United States on settlement issues.
Israel has been retaliating to the UN vote, and it said it would withhold $100 million US dollars in tax money it's collected on behalf of the Palestinian Authority. How do you see this affecting Palestinians in the West Bank, and are there more revenues that you know of that Israel could withhold?
Well, Israel is actually working hand in glove with Congress because Congress is still holding up nearly $500 million worth of U.S. aid to the Palestinians that was already approved as part of the 2012 budget. So it's clear that what's happening right now is there's an attempt by Israel and its supporters in Congress to punish Palestine for going to the U.N. to seek this upgraded status. And it's really unclear at this point, I think, where the punishment of Palestinians will end. I think Israel has a vested interest in keeping the Palestinian Authority alive and functioning because it's allowing Israel basically to subcontract out its military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank and East Jerusalem. So will Israel go as far as to bring about a collapse of the Palestinian Authority? I think we'll have to wait and see how tightly the screws will be tightened on the Palestinians.
Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much for having me.
World leaders began the second and final week of COP18 climate change negotiations in Doha, Qatar today. One of the goals of many participants is to extend the Kyoto Protocol, the only legally binding agreement to curb emissions, which is expiring at the end of the year. The United States has never ratified the treaty. Like recent gatherings, pressure is growing on rich countries to make stronger commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Sam Smith is with WWF's Climate and Energy Initiative. She says recent extreme weather events should be a wake-up call.
This issue is about the difference between science and political science, and between reality and the parallel universe that is these negotiations. Just to make it a little more clear, in 2010, Russia suffered an enormous heat wave. 50 to 70,000 people died in that heat wave. And scientists are telling us this year that it was very clearly linked to climate change. This year in the northern summer, the wheat growing areas of the Ukraine, Russia, and the United States suffered from droughts and extreme heat all at the same time, and food prices spiked, and we are now teetering on the edge of the third global food crisis since 2008.
Many have been optimistic that the U.S. might take a stronger stance in Doha following the re-election of President Obama. But at a press conference today, U.S. climate envoy Todd Stern said not to expect a major change in tone from the U.S. Instead, he said, the Obama administration has already made significant accomplishments and is on track to meet a 16% reduction in emissions through current policies that are already in place.
The president has put in place very significant regulations on the whole transportation side, taking the miles per gallon of our vehicles from around 27 to over 54 over the course of about a 12-year period, and we're in the middle of that right now. Important steps forward with respect to regulations on power plants under regulations that have been put in place essentially can't use coal unless new power plants unless those emissions can be captured.
Stern also attributed U.S. natural gas production to lowered U.S. emissions, but that practice has provoked concerns in places where residents are dealing with the consequences of hydraulic fracturing or fracking.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And that does it for our program for today, Monday, December 3rd, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. So for more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by myself. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for potentially sore throats, clapping hands, or a ghost mix.